Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome back to Black's History Week. In this episode, Professor Jeremy Black talks to Graham Stewart about how the wars with revolutionary France and annexations by Napoleon reshaped the German lands.
As with most periods of change, people prior to the outbreak of the French Revolutionary War, which for France, Austria and Prussia was in 1792, for Britain not till 1793, the people in the previous generation were not aware this was going to happen. And indeed, I think it's fair to say, and this is of course an interesting anticipation for the situation we are in at the moment, the situation was one in which other issues appeared to the fore. The rivalry between Austria and Prussia, which had led to another war in 1778 to 1779, the War of the Bavarian Succession, and which appeared to be leading to another war in 1790. And indeed, the rise of Russian power. The British commentator John Richard, observing after Russia became one of the co-guarantors of the German constitution under the Peace of Chechen of 1779, quote, "The Russians may now be considered as the arbiters of Germany, since it is evident that their conjunction with either power," by which he meant Austria or Prussia, "must overwhelm the other." And France at that juncture appeared of relatively little consequence. It had been unsuccessful in its German operations during the Seven Years' War of 1756 to 63, being humiliatingly defeated at Ransbach in 1757. It had refused to intervene in the War of the Bavarian Succession, even though it had been an ally of Austria. And in subsequent sort of disputes in the empire in Germany in the 1780s, for example, the revived Bavarian inheritance issue in 1784, the French again proved sort of reluctant to take a role. So I think it's fair to say that France did not overshadow Germany, or even for that matter, the Rhineland, the part of the empire closest to France, in the 1780s. And it would have surprised most commentators to think that it might do so. This was a world away from the age of Louis XIV. France appeared to be a state in serious difficulties, rather like Britain indeed, with it faced, as it were, had been with the loss of its American colonies, with the debacle of the Gordon Riots of 1780, etc., etc. So it appeared to be the case that the ménage à trois of Austria, Prussia and Russia was dominating and would dominate Germany, with the only other powers being those of limited consequence, being the second-rank German states, principally Bavaria and Saxony. Now, as we know, that was not what was to be the result. As we know, the French Revolution, which in 1792 appeared as Prussian forces marched on Paris from the east, getting as far as Valmy, just not very far from actually where Euro Disney is today. As they advanced in that direction, it appeared that the French Revolution would be gutted out, rather as the Dutch Patriot movement had been gutted out by Prussian forces when they invaded Holland in 1787. Well, as we know, that isn't what's to happen. And indeed, there was a riposte by the French Revolutionary forces, a very effective one in 1792, when the French advanced into the Rhineland. They were driven out by the Austrians in 1793, but they returned anew. And by 1795, Prussia had dropped out of the war against France, Prussia being more concerned with developments in Poland, as Russia was. And under the Peace of Basel of 1795, Prussia accepted French occupation of the Rhineland, where often violent French exploitation had already generated resistance. Furthermore, the Austrians agreed peace under the pressure of French successes in Italy in 1797, and the left bank of the Rhine, so that's areas that would now be part of Germany, areas around, for example, Trier, was ceded to France in a recognition by the emperor that he could not protect the empire. So at that point, I think it's fair to say that there had been a dramatic reversal, but by the scale of what was to come, the situation was to be radically different. War resumed. I don't want to give just details, but it is necessary to give some background because it's linked to the devastation of much of Germany and to a hatred on the part of many Germans for the French. And despite all the attempts, which you see endlessly by French and Francophile commentators to say nice things about the French Revolution and Napoleon, from the experience of Germans, as indeed from the experience of many Italian Spaniards, and it would have been the case for the Brits if the French had invaded, the reality of French rule was expropriation, murder, rape, and an appalling degree of brutality. And I think this is something that is very hard for people this day to understand, because obviously people are so much more affected by the aftermath of World War II and the pathological ideology of Adolf Hitler and of the Nazis, and the way Germany, including many Germans who weren't in any way members of the Nazi party, operated then. It needs to be remembered that, without suggesting that there was any equivalence, which there wasn't genocide under the French, but there was a large-scale brutality, a habitual slaughter of civilians, a habitual expropriation, and that in a way was one of the backgrounds to German history of the 19th century, because the question of whom could protect Germans necessarily became an important issue. Now, one of the answers, and the answer which the French sought to propagate, was, well, we'll protect you, because if you resist, we'll murder you and kill you and brutalize you. But if you cooperate with us, you might get killed by serving in our armies. And many Germans did, of course. But other than that, we will try and do our best to provide the security of living under tyranny. And that was a offer that the French provided. And of course, it was an offer that was sugared by the extent to which those German rulers and others who cooperated, the rulers, for example, eventually of Württemberg and Saxony and Bavaria, themselves gained additional territories and gained additional benefits. But in the meantime, what there had been is an extensive process by which, in successive wars, France annexed territory. It moved the pieces of Germany around like a sort of a board of offerings, in which it took things for itself, and then it got others who were its allies to be rewarded, and thus they were further, as it were, compromised. And the seeking the support of the detail of the defeated at the expense of others was a technique of divide and rule that the French were to employ repeatedly successfully in Germany. There's war again, the War of the Second Coalition in the late 1790s into the early 1800s, the War of the Third Coalition in the mid 1800s. And this leads to the reorganization of Germany. The creation of the Kingdom of Bavaria as an ally of Napoleon in 1806 violated the principle that there could only be one king in the empire. And as a result, later in 1806, Napoleon established an institutional basis for French intervention. He rejigged the Constitution of Germany, establishing the Rheinbund, the Confederation of the Rhine, which linked France and 16 southern and western German states, including Bavaria, Württemberg, and Baden. An alliance that was designed to limit Austrian and Prussian influence. It had a capital at Frankfurt. Napoleon became the protector of the Rheinbund, gained control over the forces and resources of the Confederation's members, and it backed him against Prussia later in 1806. There was no attempt to create an alternative to French direction. The Diet or Parliament or Reichstag of the Confederation never met. This was a truly authoritarian system and was different from the federalism of the Second Reich, let alone the First Reich. Now, Napoleon also had Francis II, the Holy Roman Empire, dissolve the empire, the First Reich. In 1806, Francis formally abdicates his role as emperor. He releases all imperial states and officials from their oaths, and he remains emperor of Austria, but in a position which is, as it were, off-centre to the new German identity being developed through the Confederation of the Rhine. Those German territories that are not absorbed within the French rule therefore become fully sovereign. So that's the situation after 1806. And it's fair to say that Germany is divided, I would say, into three categories. First, there are those sections which are annexed by the French, which become part of France. So, for example, aside from the Rhineland, which we've already mentioned, such well-known French cities as Hamburg and Lübeck and Bremen were annexed to France in 1810, the same year in which the territory of Oldenburg was annexed, followed by Swedish Pomerania, that's Western Pomerania, currently northeast Germany, which was annexed to France in 1812. So there was first that. Secondly, there was the significant expansion of the French territories, Bavaria, Württemberg, or for that matter, Napoleon making his brother Jerome King of Westphalia in 1807. And then there are one or two smaller territories which, as it were, sit rather quietly under the overall control of France. In the longest occupied part of Germany, the Rhineland, there was an attempt to impose French structures, including over matters of the church and language. The Rhinelanders became, as they were referred to by some contemporaries, New French. But in practice, Frenchification had a limited effect, not least because the French were continually dependent on the local elites, but also due to the maintenance of German language and German education. And I think it's fair to say that we don't know what would have happened in hindsight, but I think it's fair to say that Frenchification was much less, particularly east of the Rhine, than might have been anticipated. And I think it's fair to say that it was less than it was the case of, for example, what is subsequently to be called Belgium. Nevertheless, by 1812, Napoleon was able to take many allied German units, including from Prussia, from Bavaria, from Saxony, from Westphalia, from Baden and from Berg, when he invaded Russia. And at that point, France very much dominates the German system to an extent that would have caused later French politicians a degree of euphoria that might have brought on a heart attack. Now, over to you, Graham.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Black. I want to start, there's a lot to unpick here, but I want to start by asking, going back to 1792 and the beginning of the French Revolutionary Wars, one can see why Austria wanted to attack the new French Republic. Marie Antoinette, obviously an Austrian princess, imprisoned and going to be guillotined. But what was Prussia's motivation to get so heavily involved in attacking France?
Ah, well, you need to read my book on strategy in the French Revolution and Napoleonic Wars. I'm shocked that you haven't done so yet. Starting off, I think one can fairly say that for the Prussians, there is two elements. One, there is an anxiety to be left out if the Austrians successfully, as is widely assumed to be the case, reimpose control in France, and this would have been an enormous disappointment to Frederick William II to be left out, because there were prospects of gains, territorial and otherwise, to be made. But also, like many rulers, he is anxious about the radicalism that the French, the French revolutionaries offer. So that degree is important.
And moving to the bits, the German lands, which are steadily occupied, annexed and allied to France, starting with the Rhineland itself, should we see this purely as a strategic aim of France to give themselves a harder border with the German lands than they've had? That border has shifted around over the previous centuries. Or did they actually see the people of the Rhineland as either potentially French or people who could be made to become French over a period of time? What was this a form of colonization, or was it really just more a military moving of the fortifications?
Well, again, that's a fascinating question. I think there's a number of elements. First of all, ideology plays a role, as it does for the Soviets and for the Nazis. So, in response to appeals for help from radicals in Mainz in particular, which is a major German city and one of totemic significance, but also, for example, from Zweibrücken, the National Convention in Paris passes a decree declaring that the French people would extend fraternity and assistance to all people seeking to regain their liberty. Well, I think it's fair to say that this is not, as it were, the language is that of democracy. The practice is not a democracy. These are tiny groups of Jacobin radicals who the French try and create and construct, at that period, moving towards the Jacobin takeoff in France and the Terror, they try and construct surrogate similar states in both, in the Low Countries, in Germany, in Switzerland, and in Northern Italy. That, I think it's fair to say, is not a theme that is persisted in. I think it's fair to say that under the Directory and then Napoleon, you have a degree of pulling back and a degree of reformism that is linked to working with those who could be those elite members or would-be elite members who could be persuaded to be pro-French. So when you're looking at French expansion east of the Rhine, which was not new with the revolutionaries, you could see that under Louis XIV, for example, with his interest in places like Freiburg. But when you see that, I think it's fair to say that what you have got is talk about sort of the natural frontiers of France reaching to the Rhine and the Alps and the Pyrenees, a hogwash. They want to go much further than that. There isn't any real idea of natural frontiers. And indeed, one of the great intellectual flaws and practical flaws of the revolution, as with most radical movements, whether domestic or international, is they propound an ideology which does not in practice have any limits. So that not only creates problems for them, it creates the issues of anxiety and uncertainty for others. Now, you do get occasional ideological movements that don't do that. I mean, the American revolutionaries propounded in the Declaration of Independence of 1776 a universal ideology about human happiness, and the last thing they tried to do was to enforce it anywhere else. But the French revolutionaries, you could say, in a different environment, you could make whatever excuses you like for them, but the practicality was that in a sort of prefiguring Putinesque fashion, there was no obvious limit other than their own will to their interpretation of their destiny.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. It's interesting to me, this idea not only of France taking places like Hamburg and Lübeck that, you know, could never plausibly pass themselves off as a naturally French place. I don't know whether you've seen evidence to suggest the French really felt they could hold these places indefinitely, or whether it was just a temporary expedient to make the most of having economically successful cities and ports that they could control for the time being. What is your feeling about how opportunistic this was, as distinct from I wouldn't say a Lebensraum, because that analogy is too strong, but too inaccurate. But nevertheless, a sense that, you know, the French were there with a plan to stay.
Well, that's very interesting. I mean, I certainly think that in the case of the territorial extension of France under Napoleon, there is no suggestion that they would do anything other than stay. There is the problem created by the French system, and particularly Napoleon, that the notion is that, if your interests and assumptions are not fulfilled, then others are letting you down and you need to act against them. So, issuing the commercial blockade of Britain, the continental system, in 1806, issued, of course, from Berlin by Napoleon as conqueror, is very much one that creates difficulties for commercial interests on the German coast, and indeed for the Dutch as well, which then means that France under Napoleon feels itself obliged to extend its power in order to enforce its new commercial system. Just as, for example, that is the prime reason for the invasion of Russia in 1812, that Tsar Alexander won't do what Napoleon wants. Well, this isn't a terribly brilliant way to proceed. It is a strategically extraordinarily naive process, because it just causes the accumulation of opponents and those who are dissatisfied. So I would say, and you know, you've already seen, I mean, in the most brutal case, which was after Prussia was defeated in the War of the Third Coalition, there is an extensive expansion of French and French allied territories, the permanent occupation of the major fortresses in eastern Prussia, the cession of all Prussian territories west of the Elbe to France, a massive indemnity, a network of French military roads across the kingdom, the limitation of the Prussian army and its support in any conflict with Austria, and the demand for the free transit of French goods. These were terms that for Prussia were far worse even than those for Germany in 1918. Obviously, on one hand, the shock of defeat encourages calls for German nationalization. For example, the addresses to the German nation in 1808 by Fichte, with the theme of a German common identity. But leaving aside what's going to happen to German nationalism, and we can discuss the strengths and weaknesses of that, leaving that aside, the French have put themselves into a position where they can't, as it were, draw back. You know, they have created this dominance, which then their identity is going to be focused on. And that, in a sense, is a form of weakness.
And tell me, a bit more about the sense of the French ideas, or maybe I just mean the French rhetoric, the revolutionary rhetoric. Was that made more palatable once Napoleon was emperor for German lands that were either going to ally with France or in any way come under their sphere of influence, if not direct control? Or did that revolutionary rhetoric and the supposed universality of it, was that still one of the main barriers for German resistance?
Well, I think what I would fairly say is that although you might think that the French revolutionaries were worse, the practicality was that much of Germany had not seen a French soldier by 1795. And although thereafter there was some movement east of the Rhine, nevertheless, much of northern Germany, of Bavaria, of Saxony, of Prussia, hadn't seen a German soldier until the War of the Third Coalition, really. There'd been, obviously, German troops went into Bavaria during the latter stages of the War of the Second Coalition. But much of Germany, no. So the practicality is that the demands are much more onerous under Napoleon, and they culminate, of course, in the thing that is worst of all, which is the enforced service of large numbers of German men in military units under French control, often ones that bear no reference to any understanding of any Germanic or part of Germanic interest, for example, fighting the Brits in Iberia or fighting the Russians. And again, you know, you're right, we want to be very, very careful about comparisons. I think these have always difficult. But I think it's fair to say that you know, there is an uneasy similarity to the way in which Europeans served or were made to serve or made to be part of the machine of the Third Reich.
We inevitably look back on this period, the beginning of the 19th century, from the perspective of knowing that by the 1870s, Germany is united. And so we look back at this earlier period and ask ourselves questions about, you know, where were the seeds of this unity coming, which is dangerous to do, because the people of the early 19th century weren't thinking in the way that those in the 1870s were. But nevertheless, 1806, do you see that as a pivotal year in the ultimate creation of a German political identity? You've got the Rheinbund you spoke of, the 16 states coming together with a capital at Frankfurt, and you've got the end of the Holy Roman Empire.
Well, I think that's very, very interesting. I mean, I think it's certainly important, but I don't think it makes inevitable or even probable any particular outcome. There is a whole series of uncertainties. Indeed, right up, I would say, to 1813. I think after the Battle of Leipzig, the Battle of the Nations, and Napoleon's very serious defeat and the collapse of his alliance system in Germany, thereafter, although there are different ways things could have gone in 1814, the possibility of his holding on to power in 1815, the possibility of his return, in practical terms, the likelihood of Napoleon being in a dominant position in Germany after the end of 1813 is implausible. But prior to that, there are multiple uncertainties. And the Rheinbund, to me, I mean, obviously, I'm well aware that there is a literature that is more sympathetic to it, but to me, is very much a political system in the shadow of a foreign conqueror. And I don't think that would have been an attractive perspective basis for a German political identity of any type. Now, the interesting thing is that the eventual defeat of France, the creation of a revived German system by the Congress of Vienna of 1814 to 15, creates something which in some respects is a continuation of what we've been recently having, in the sense it's uncertain how it will bed out in practice. But nevertheless, it is one in which there are more German stakeholders, and those stakeholders are less dependent on the intervention, volition, direct or indirect, of non-German powers. Now, that's a separate question from the one that I think you were also driving at, which is how far is there what one might term a German identity in the early 19th century? And what I would say, and I hope listeners have heard the earlier programs, is there was a German identity earlier than that, but the what one should really be thinking of is in terms of identities, that people have a multiple set of identities. They might consider themselves a guild member, a citizen of Munich, a subject of the Wittelsbach Elector of Bavaria, a subject of the empire. And those are not necessarily incompatible, though at times, of course, the Wittelsbachs fight the emperors. But they're not necessarily incompatible in their minds. And the kind of it has to be one or the other is not to the fore, I think. I also would suggest that, as with most senses of identity, there is an uncertainty at the margins, that the First Reich had most obviously extended into northern Italy, which is not the situation that pertains after the Congress of Vienna with the reconceptualized Reich. But I think that as far as what we might see as Germany as a whole, I don't think that's a particular issue. And what I would argue is that if you look at the German Confederation founded in 1815, which has Austria with a permanent presidency and is a union of sovereign princes and free cities, it is in many respects closer, although far from identical, to the model of the First Reich than it is to what had been there under the shadow of French power.
And would you say that that post-war settlement fundamentally made much difference to the level of power that the court in Vienna, the Habsburgs, had over Germany, even though they were no longer Holy Roman Emperors?
Oh, that's a fascinating question. I mean, I would say there'd been no set amount of power prior to 1792, that a lot had depended upon circumstances, both of the individual emperors, of the political situation within the Reich, and of the actions of non-German powers and of other Austrian interests. And I would say substantially those factors all maintained the situation after 1815. There are some clear weaknesses for Austria, or the Austrian Emperor, the Emperor of Austria. The ecclesiastical principalities, which had been a major support for the Holy Roman Empire and for the position of the emperor, those had all gone. And that, I think, is very significant. That's a secularization of German territorial power, and that weakens the prestige, the ambiance of both the Habsburgs and, incidentally, also the Bavarian Wittelsbachs. And also, the Austrians have lost some of their territories. For example, the Black Forest possessions that they had lost in 1805 to Baden and Württemberg at the behest of, Austria, they don't regain. So there isn't the spread out nature of Austrian territory there'd been, whereas in contrast, Prussian territory or territories ruled by the Hohenzollern of Prussia extend now very strongly into the Rhineland. Prussia gains much of Westphalia and the Lower Rhineland, including Cologne, Koblenz, Munster and Trier, which is a major extension of Protestant rule and Prussian rule over Catholics. And there isn't this comparable Austrian rule over Protestants. And I think it's fair to say that although Austria is the stronger power than Prussia in this period, nevertheless, I think there are signs of Prussia being better able to present itself as a champion of German national integrity, for example, most notably against France.
Looking more at life for citizens in German lands, or say citizens, rather French term, for people in the German lands, would you say you can see there's a period of obvious social change and perhaps even political radicalization in the decade or so after the Congress of Vienna compared to the decade or so before the beginning of the French Revolutionary Wars?
Actually, I think that's a really interesting question. I think there is a, as you may know, there are a number of problems in the assessment of the early 19th century, the decades after 1815. And I've written about these elsewhere. And I think it's fair to say that in my view, a lot of the literature on the 19th century Europe is poor because it tends to be teleological. It knows where things are going. And it's almost as if it regrets that radicalism isn't more successful. I would say that's not a very helpful approach. There's good work on Italy in this period, and there's good work in other parts of Europe, arguing that in the past we've underrated the extent of conservatism after 1815. And not surprisingly, areas that have been exposed to French rule, to the expropriation organized by the French, were apt to regard radicals as sort of what we might call quisling figures. And I think it's also fair to say that the seizure of church assets under the French, and at times the quite hostile approach to religion, was one that was not generally welcome. And as you know, there is a strong strand of scholarship which argues that the traditional accounts have been overly secular, have failed to emphasize sufficiently the real and independent character of people's religious convictions. And by independent, I mean it's not simply the product of some other political or economic interest. Now, from that perspective, the kind of, system created in 1814-15 and that prevailed afterwards was less weak, indeed stronger, than might otherwise appear the case.
And I would just want to end on a thought. So much of the period we're talking about from the Reformation through the 17th century, we talk about the religious divisions in the German lands, and then the period of the wars and conflicts with France, the end of the 18th, beginning of the 19th century, religion doesn't really get a look in. Should it? Is there a religious dimension to this period of strife with France or not?
Oh, definitely. And I think a lot of the literature is ridiculous from that point of view. I think that, you know, if you've read my Europe in the 18th century, you will know I emphasize very strongly the role of faith in the churches, and that remains the case in the 19th century, and it's the failure of a lot of historians to accept that, that actually, I think, weakens their general overall accounts.
Well, we'll pick up in the next episode about Germany in the 19th century as it moves towards the period of Bismarck and the Wars of Unification. But for talking to us about the late 18th and early 19th century and the ways in which France attempted to dominate, to unify, and to split up the German lands, Professor Black, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today, the current offer of 5 issues for £10, by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.